Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Hey, everybody. We've got a great one today. You know, for a change, Frank Foer, who's been with me before. Frank is a friend of mine, and I also believe a national treasure, one of the founders of Slate. Great journalist, writes now a lot of cover stories for Atlantic Monthly. Probably did the definitive piece on Manafort a while back. He's also been very much on the forward edge of talking about these, these monopolies like Google and Amazon and Facebook. Today, that's what we're going to talk about. He wrote a book, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. He wrote this in 2017. Very influential book, very influential to me. I was in the Senate then and basically called for antitrust action against those companies. And Frank and I have had kind of an ongoing discussion on Facebook, too. And today, that's what he's talking about. And he is the most articulate explainer. And you see how inarticulate I am. Did I just say that? He's the most articulate explainer? Wow. Okay. Anyway, he, you're going to really love this. I'm going to just play now just a little clip from it, which says a lot. So here, this is a clip that you'll hear again later in the show.
I think one of the things that is also at the core of everything we've talked about and is, I think, the problem at the essence of Facebook is that there is this amorality to the way that it approaches the world. It's possible to be a believer in free speech and also have an ethics that guides your practice. But there's just kind of zero ethic in this company. And that's one of the, I think, big revelations that we now have a trove, not just of their research, but of the internal company message boards. And there are good people who work at Facebook, and they were troubled by what they saw. And part of what troubled them the most is that they couldn't get Mark Zuckerberg to care.
Wow. Wow. That kind of says it all, but it doesn't, actually. There's you're going to really, really love this interview or this podcast. We recorded this a few weeks ago, and Meta was announced like the day or two after we recorded this. I think we talk about it a little bit. To me, Meta is like, if you like The Matrix, you'll love Meta. First of all, I don't know what it is. That's one thing. But I think it's a lot of virtual reality, and there's a commercial for it, which explains nothing. There is a commercial where it has this art gallery-like, and it's kind of neat art. I like the art. They're looking at some art. There's some people, young people looking at art. And then the art kind of starts talking to them, and it gets very three-dimensional. And then they're like in a jungle or something. And then at the end, it says, it's going to be fun. And one, that isn't fun. I don't find the commercial fun. And I dare anyone to find that fun. If this is like bad messaging to me. I don't get what it is, but I think it is Meta is going to be, as it progresses, and remember, this is the beginning of it. This is going to go on, presumably, for years and decades, and to the point where we will have no physical being ourselves. We will be just brains somewhere, and I don't know where. I think that's what meta is. I may be wrong, but I think that's what meta is. Anyway, there's that. This is a real diversion here. So I've been on tour, and it's been great. The other, I do questions and answers at one point. You submit questions, because there's a lot of questions, and I can't do them all. And I do, and I draw the map of the United States while I answer the questions. So it's pretty impressive, if I do say so myself. So one of the questions I got asked was like this really strange question. Were you in Washington on January 6th, and what did you want to do? And I was there because my daughter's family was there, and we were in their bubble. I was very lucky as a grandparent. Me and my wife were able to put the kids to bed. We were able to take care of them during the day. It was great from the standpoint of being a grandparent. And I was about, I don't know, a 35-minute drive from the Capitol, and I start seeing this thing going down there, and I did not know how serious this was. At first, I don't think anybody realized that, and it's grown more and more serious as the more we've seen. But my first instinct, and this came to me in a flash, was to put clown makeup on, put a big clown wig on, a shower cap for some reason, a big pink robe, like a fluffy robe, big pink slippers, and to bring a frying pan and go down there and just bop demonstrators, or the insurgents, actually, on the head with the frying pan. I don't know why. I don't know how to explain this, but it just all came to me at once. In a flash, this is what I should do. This would have been the perfect note. Because there would have been like archival footage. There would have been news crews there, and they would have caught, you know, this clown hitting the insurgents on the head with a frying pan. Now, this was very, it was conceptual. I didn't want to hurt anybody. I never have hurt anybody. And you could really do a number on someone, hitting him over the head with a frying pan. But still, I think that if I had done that and been able to manage to not hurt people, and this footage existed, it would have actually framed the whole damn thing historically perfectly. Because this was by the way, I think this tells you that I've successfully made the transition from senator to comedian or entertainer, I think, or that my brain has in many ways. But that was, that's exactly what I thought of. Okay, Frank Four is with us to talk about Facebook, and it's not pretty, folks. It's not pretty, but I'll tell you one thing. You're going to love this one for a change. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
You wrote about Facebook when? 2017, I think?
That's when my book came out.
World Without Mind. Great book. I think an important book, important to me, if that makes it important, but also important to a lot of other people, because I think you identified this. I think you identified this not just about Facebook, but about Google, Amazon. Can you summarize what you saw there? What World Without Mind was about? Do you mind doing that?
Sure. I mean, so Silicon Valley went around masquerading as if it were creating this democratic environment for the world where it was empowering individuals to have a megaphone where they could express themselves. And so it sounded really great on paper. Lots of people in the world, in Washington, in media, were entranced by the utopia that Silicon Valley promised.
And it is a utopia of sorts.
It was
a negative utopia, like Logan's Run.
What they sold was utopia.
Yeah.
But what ended up being was something close to the opposite. And so instead of creating this democratic environment where everybody had agency, what they created were these highly centralized platforms where power was invisible, but immense. And so you had a handful of engineers in Silicon Valley who had the ability to manipulate people at will. And their goal was to extract as much profit from the poor suckers that are us out there in the world. And they did it by using their algorithms, by engaging in doublespeak. And, you know, all the while, they were constructing this ecosystem that was, in fact, hostile to democracy, hostile to economic empowerment, that it became something of the opposite of what they promised. And they weren't held to account. And they're still not really actually being held to account. I mean, Facebook is facing an incredible public relations crisis. But with all of these revelations about these companies, it's not like we're getting a flood of legislation or regulation that would fundamentally alter their behavior.
I get the sense that both the right and conservative Republicans and the left now, but now it's moving toward the center, are going like, hey, this is a problem. Let's do something about it and let's pound the table and do something about it. But I don't see the left and the right coming together on this. Do you have any thoughts about that?
They could. I mean, when you look at the hearings that they hold on big tech, there tends to be more consensus than you find on virtually any other topic.
It's consensus on what the problem is. Is there a consensus on how to solve it, though?
You know, I actually think that there probably is some broad consensus about what to be done. I think both the left and right care about privacy. I think both left and right care about what these platforms do to kids. And I think that both left and right have reasons to feel politically aggrieved by the manipulative platform that is Facebook. I mean, the right feels like it's been deplatformed by Facebook. The left feels like Facebook was just a mechanism for proliferating conspiracies like QAnon and for spreading hate speech. And they both probably have a point at the end of the day. And maybe you're right that their diagnosis of what's wrong with Facebook is somewhat incompatible, but I think that they could both agree that the power of Facebook over democratic space should be decreased.
I agree that they agree on that. I just don't know how they're going to approach that, how they would approach that. I've talked to Sheldon Whitehouse about this, and he says, I said, where are you guys going? And he says, I don't know, because we don't seem to have the same approach at all. Now, one thing you hear about is Section 230. Why don't you explain to the folks what Section 230 is?
So in 1996, Congress passed a piece of legislation called the Communications Decency Act, which essentially exempted the internet from the laws that applied to every other source of media in the country. So the platforms in the internet, you could publish or repost content on your site, on your platform, and essentially you were exempt from all the other, you were immunized from legal action that would be directed at you in other circumstances. So when Facebook publishes misinformation or libelous posts, they're never going to be held to account legally for that until Section 230 is repealed.
And there was a good reason for this, free speech, right? And so that these are platforms, they're not publishers, they're platforms that give an airing to any opinion, any point of view. And that was, when was this, 1995 or something?
Yeah, 96. And there was also the sense that the internet was different, that the internet was ushering in some sort of new age. So the law itself reflected the utopian spirit that permeates the ideology of Silicon Valley.
So that's where we were in 1996. We had this utopian idea about all this information getting, oh my God, data is just doubling every year. I heard that some kind of rule. Is there a rule of that?
There's so many iron rules about the way that the internet is supposed to behave that justifies it being exempt from logic, reason, and morality.
By the way, part of the data that's doubling every year, you think of it as, wow, mankind's knowledge is really just increasing, just gangbusters. But a lot of the knowledge is the best way to sell diapers to pregnant women.
Or pornography.
Yeah. So Section 230 says basically you can put up QAnon information, you can put up hate information. The platform is not responsible for that because it's just a platform. People are putting that up. And to bring that right up to date, what you're seeing is that Facebook is doing that, and they're doing that all over the world. And it's in some places it's causing genocide, which I would think you would, if you were Mark Zuckerberg,
human being,
you might go like, when I went into this, I thought more it'd be more like dating and less genocide.
Yeah. Yeah. Cat photos, not people being chased in pogroms. Yeah, it's kind of incredible. I mean, I think one of the things that is also at the core of everything we've talked about and is, I think, the problem at the essence of Facebook is that there's this amorality to the way that it approaches the world. It's possible to be a believer in free speech and also have an ethics that guides your practice. But there's kind of zero ethic in some company. And that's one of the, I think, big revelations that we now have a trove, not just of their research, but of the internal company message boards. And there are good people who work at Facebook, and they were troubled by what they saw. And part of what they troubled them the most is that they couldn't get Mark Zuckerberg to care. I mean, there's just like a quality to him that he's a stone, that he's got kind of a stone heart. and
it's funny because I'm not a reader of body language or personality. And when I look at him, I think, now there's a warm guy. See, yeah. I got it so wrong. He's been fooling me for so long. So let's talk about the revelations that we've seen in the last months. We have Haugen, whistleblower. Francis Haugen. And then further stuff that's coming out. Let's talk about the latest revelations and then work backward to what it tells us about what you were saying 4 years ago.
Right. So Francis Haugen was an engineer at Facebook who seems to have been one of the employees who was just dismayed by what the company was doing. And so on her way out the door, she collected this enormous trove of internal documents, and she handed them over to the Security and Exchange Commission and to Congress. And what the documents provide is this kind of crystal clear window into not just the internal workings of the company, but kind of its collective brain and into Mark Zuckerberg's brain. And, you know, at the core, I think, of the things that are most devastating to learn about Facebook is that Facebook has this incredible internal research apparatus. And so it's not just collecting data, it's studying its data. And its research teams were also considering, you know, or seems to be considering some of the moral questions that are at the heart of Facebook. Like, you know, how was it that QAnon was able to proliferate on Facebook for so long? Why is it that teenage girls end up having suicidal thoughts after joining Instagram? And so with its own metrics, you were able to see the ways in which Facebook is doing enormous harm to the world. And then on top of that, you see the conversations that follow the publication of the research, where there are people who are troubled by what they were learning about their own company in the course of this research. And then that research, those conversations travel to the top of the company, and they tend to get shut down by Zuckerberg, who is a very, very hands-on, in the weeds, imperious CEO. The company is Mark Zuckerberg, and he, using some of his more utopian language, finds ways to deflect what he's being told by his researchers and says, you know, if we make these changes that you're proposing, we would be, in fact, shutting down what he calls meaningful human interaction. Now, let's just pause here on the term meaningful human interaction in the context of Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, it's kind of almost an oxymoron at that stage, probably. But
well, you don't know him. I mean, he seems like someone. I know what you're saying, though.
And so it's you know, maybe other companies are exactly like this. Maybe if we went to other Silicon Valley giants, we'd find kind of disturbing revelations of this kind. But I think what happened at Facebook is that, you know, Facebook, we live in this age of political anger where people just want to rip the heads off of their perceived enemies. And we see that every day in the United States. And it's relatively mild here compared to other countries around the world. And you have to ask yourself, why is it that we've entered into this era where political rhetoric has grown so violent? And the answer is that our anger has been stoked by Facebook. That when we see these documents, you can see just perfectly clearly how the Facebook algorithm was engineered in order to spread anger, to make us even more angry, to allow conspiracy to spread. I think, you know, the cliche is it's a feature, not a bug. And I think that is totally true about Facebook, that in order to get people hooked on the platform, in order to get them addicted to their heroin, it exploited this tendency that humans have to be easily riled to anger. And so it fine-tuned its algorithm in order to make us more angry.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Frank Foer and our discussion of Facebook.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
we really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
So let's talk about two things then. Algorithms, and then talk about the revelations of late, the specific ones that made us go like, Jesus Christ. Well, one was giving into Vietnam, right?
Yeah.
Vietnam said, you can't operate here, Facebook, unless you put out the information that we, the government of Vietnam, want you to put out.
Right, which is a good example because it kind of puts the lie to Zuckerberg's rhetoric about free speech, that in the United States, he is reluctant to crack down on hate speech because he's upholding some principle. But, you know, when it came to getting kicked out of a market in Asia, he was only too happy to surrender his principle there.
So there's a number of these examples where he's given a choice, more profits or cracking down on disinformation and hate speech. And he always seems to pick more profits.
Yeah, there's a great book that just came out by two New York Times reporters, Cecilia Kang and Shira Frankel. And they say that when Zuckerberg would end various meetings, he would end them with the slogan, company over country. Now, that's kind of an incredible cell phone, as they say, to make that your motto. And it's true that like company over country means company over common good, company over public safety, company over civil discourse, company over democracy. You know, it's there. It's in his own words, essentially.
Yeah, profits over less killing. I'm just trying to make it. Let's talk about the algorithm, right? Okay, the algorithms, because I'm fascinated with this, and they control the algorithm. They make their own algorithm, and their algorithm is about figuring out what keeps you on Facebook, because their whole business plan is advertising, and so it's all about keeping you on the platform.
Yeah.
And they try to figure out, they know you better than you know you, because you on Facebook make decisions all the time. And the algorithm is a form of artificial intelligence. And it looks at all these choices and said, looks like that this guy really likes to get agitated. So let's agitate him with some fake information. Now, this is what bugs me, because when they say, yeah, we have no way of knowing of keeping track of this fake information, they're the one giving it to people.
Yeah. You know, and they're interesting. It's an interesting point of comparison that as bad as things are in the United States, their algorithms are fine tuned differently here than they are in other countries. So they actually do, if you can believe it, a better job of pruning hate speech here than they do in, say, Ethiopia, where, you know, another place where they're arguably responsible for pogroms. So the algorithm is, it has this kind of mystique surrounding it. It sounds like it's this kind of advanced mathematical term. It sounds like, you know, in the past, Facebook has kind of said, you know, we don't actually know how our own algorithms work because there's so much machine learning is being fed into it. They're these sensitive mechanisms that are always refining themselves. And so the algorithm itself became something that kind of resided beyond our ability to control it. But in fact, the algorithm is tightly controlled by Facebook. And so the illusion of Facebook was that it was, you were just getting this kind of chronological feed of posts from your friends. But in fact, there's a hierarchy that Facebook is imposing on the stuff that you're reading in your newsfeed. And they decide to elevate certain things and bury other things. And it's the algorithm that's doing it. And so in part, it's doing it based on this understanding of you that you just described, where it's collecting data about your reading habits because it's following you all across the web as you're reading. And maybe it's integrating some other data from other sources. And so it's compiling this dossier of your tendencies, and then it's arraying information in order to kind of keep you hanging on, keep you reading for as long as possible. So that's one part of it. But then there's this other part of the way that the algorithm works, where the control of it is actually highly centralized, because Facebook is setting policies constantly that govern the way in which the algorithm is displaying information to you. And so when it decides, you know, we want to make you a little bit less angry, or we want to have more cat photos or pictures from your high school friends at the top of your newsfeed, it can turn the dials to make that happen. And like I said, that's policy at Facebook. They turn up the anger, they turn down the anger, they turn up the politics, they turn down the politics. And they do it in order to keep their numbers where they want to keep them, in order to keep growing. Sometimes they, you know, like you said, during the election, they turn down the misinformation in order to avoid getting caught in embarrassing scandals that might lead to their own regulation. So they have control over it.
Okay, this to me begs this question, which is, if they can fine tune this, if they control their algorithm, if the algorithm is deciding what you're seeing in order to keep you on or do whatever it wants you to do, how is it not possible for the algorithm to go like, oh, no, 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 we know that's lying. We know that we know that's fake information, so we shouldn't give it to anybody. How is that? How are those two things not connected? That's what I keep trying to figure out. It's like, no, we have this algorithm that finally computes what keeps you on. And keeping a lot of people on is getting them agitated. And getting them agitated is feeding them fake information.
If Mark Zuckerberg wanted Facebook to be different, it could be different. There's no reason that Facebook couldn't actually be a more healthy way to learn about the world. There's just no reason that it couldn't be that way.
Has anyone asked him that when he's been testifying? Has anyone asked him exactly the question I've asked, which is, wait, whoa, 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 whoa. Your algorithms are designed to do this. Why can't you design them to identify hate speech and then go right away, go, nope, 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 nope. Why can't they do that?
I mean, in part, it's he wants to maintain traffic to the site so that he can sell ads against it.
I know why. I'm not saying, like, why can't you do that?
He's somewhat honest about this, which is that he has tremendous power, but he doesn't want to actually fully realize his power. He doesn't want to be the one who's making decisions about what's true and what's not true.
But there's stuff that's true and there's stuff that's not true, and we kind of know that.
Yes, but like, you know, it's like we live in some ways we live in a world that where truth is eroded. Like, you do have incredibly partisan ideological views of the way that the world works that claim to be representations of truth. And so, you know, I'll give you one example that cuts close to home for me, which is I believe that Russia played a role in the 2016 election.
Duh.
Yeah. And so I have some basis for saying that, but I think that you'd find a lot of conservatives who would say, like, that's a conspiracy theory. And that's like extrapolating facts, and there's a contested narrative there that, you know, Robert Mueller didn't come to exactly the same conclusion that I came to. So that's not true. Maybe they should be, you know, it's a toxic theory that should be taken down from the web.
He kind of did, though.
Yeah, I think he could easily do much, 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 much better. And he could create a world that's not so terrible. but I also am somewhat sympathetic to his view that he's going to be stuck in knotty questions all the time. The idea of truth is not as cut and dry as we'd like it to be.
Yes and no, though. For example, saying that Antifa and Black Lives Matter were the ones who raided the Capitol on January 6th. First of all, Black Lives Matter did an excellent job of hiding their race on January 6th, I would say. And also, look at the people who are being tried. None of them are Antifa. None of them are Black Lives Matter. We know where they're from. They are on tape. They have visual of them. We know exactly who they are. No one can find a frame of someone from who's known Antifa. No one can find a frame of a Black Lives Matter person. But they're frame after frame after frame after frame of these people who are indicted, and they're none of them are them. How right. can you be Mark Zuckerberg and go like, you know, I just can't tell the difference?
Right. Well, so I mean, I think that it's also there's like a further element that needs to be introduced into the way that they govern themselves, which is like he needs to be responsible. And so it's not just regulating truth. I think that if we make it a question about regulating truth, then he can engage in arguments over that all day long. And sure, we're in a philosophical seminar. But I think that when we look at kind of the real world harm that certain conspiracies play, like we should, you know, that becomes the thing that really should motivate them to clean up their platform. It's, you know, we can argue about different, like the way that different medicines work, but like when it comes to vaccine misinformation, like you're actually, you know, Biden said this and got in trouble, but I think he was right that like Facebook was actually killing people by allowing misinformation about the vaccine to spread. Like, you know, there might be two sides to like a civil war, but like, you know, that there's certain hate speech that's being used to rile up people to get them to kill their neighbors. Like that's where, you know, things are wrong. It's like they don't need to be arbiters of every single point of fact, but what they do need to do is to recognize that their system is being exploited by bad political actors to cause enormous harm to people. And that's what they should be regulating.
I'll give you examples. You were talking about Russia in 2016. There's no Mueller indicted the operation in St. Petersburg, right?
Yep.
So it's not like he didn't say that was happening. Also, Facebook, which denied taking ads from Russia during the campaign and the immediate aftermath, later said, oh, yeah, we did. And I was in the judiciary hearing with the lead counsel from Facebook. Russia had paid for them in rubles.
I believe in the arguments that I'm making, and I believe that they're true. But I also think that there are parts of political discourse where you and a conservative could have a different view about like the spending, like about an element of Medicare. And like you can have a debate over whether works or not, right? And so you could extrapolate facts in different way, and you can maybe even have two different sets of facts, because a conservative think tank may be producing a version of facts that I find to be incredibly dishonest. But like, do we really want Facebook in the business of saying, you know, this think tank's white paper is true or not true? This one, you know, the other side's is true or not.
Okay, but what's the distinction between that and there are pedophiles holding children captive in a pizza parlor in D.C. and killing them and drinking their blood?
Yeah, so I think that like there's a pretty good distinction, like that is a crazy theory that's going to cause people to act in a way that is going to have immediate real world violent consequences.
Okay. So how do you make the distinction between crazy and really kind of crazy and just a difference in looking at data on how many people have benefited from Medicaid expansion?
Right. So newspapers, I would submit, kind of manage to do this constantly. And so like the Washington Post publishes an op-ed page where, you know, for the most part, they set guardrails about what's acceptable difference of opinion and what's like what's an unacceptable opinion. And so I don't think that the Washington Post would publish like a pro Pizzagate op-ed, yet they would publish an attack on Medicare that might be disingenuous and tendentious.
Right.
It's like, it's not that hard to make these distinctions.
That's kind of what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the problem isn't the Wall Street Journal editorial page, which is kind of lying all the time. But the problem is the stuff that stokes violence and stokes things like January 6th and says that the election was stolen and says Dominion changed the votes and that Smartmatic was did their software in their machines, and it didn't.
Yeah. Right. Well, we have evidence of a real world example of how they were able to do better, which was during the 2020 election, they had like an integrity team that did a great job of shutting down foreign influence campaigns on the platform and that tweaked the algorithms to try to, you know, curb the conspiracy theories during the election. And then as soon as the election was over, they gave up on that project.
Yeah. And why can't Congress go like, why did you give up on that project exactly? And could you not do that again? Mr. Zuckerberg, thank you for appearing today and answering these questions honestly. Wait a minute. I'm sorry. You're Mark Zuckerberg.
So I think I've argued in the course of this podcast that Facebook could do better. But I don't actually believe in my heart that Facebook could be reformed so that it's not a pernicious entity. I think there's actually something pernicious at the core of it, where
that's unless true. That's what you've written. And let's go to that. Let's just go to that.
It would have to become an entirely different company where it was making editorial decisions, where it got rid of the like button and actually shut people out, because you can deplatform the president, but are you going to deplatform every crazy uncle in America who has like a ridiculous opinion? You know, the democratization of opinion that Facebook has proliferated is, you know, it has advantages, but for every Arab Spring, you know, they're like four genocides that have been perpetrated by it. Like I'm just very skeptical that you can have an entity with the scale that Facebook has, with the mission that Facebook has, and I think it's always going to be a menace to civilization. We don't have one newspaper. We have a diversity, there's pluralism when it comes to our news sources. The problem with Facebook is its scale and the influence that it has on the people who consume information through it. And so I think that Facebook is an antitrust problem. It's a monopoly problem. And I think actually that's the way in which the government is going to deal with it ultimately.
And you're talking sort of these platform wide, like Google and Amazon, and all those are anti-competitive.
Yeah, but Facebook, I think, is maybe the simplest case of them all, because it did so much to acquire its competitors and to acquire this kind of dominant position that it holds by buying WhatsApp and by buying Instagram. And so it's actually a pretty easy company to unwind. And I think if you were to dismember the company in that sort of way, it would fade relatively quickly. Because Facebook is the source of is the source of everything for him, but he's trying to move beyond it into becoming a metaverse company, whatever that means.
What does that mean? What metaverse is that? Is that his phrase?
That's his phrase. And so, if you're accused of being kind of a creepy, irresponsible company, why not go to the next stage of creepiness and irresponsibility? And so it's a company that is supposed to aggregate virtual reality, augmented reality with social media. And nobody exactly knows what it means, but he gave a kind of a humorous, unintentionally humorous demonstration of what the metaverse would look like, kind of strolling through his home in Hawaii as a virtual character, Mark Zuckerberg.
Okay, I
would explain it in greater depth, but I don't understand it in any greater depth.
Yeah, that's a good rule for all my guests. Thank you. I think we're going to establish that. Don't explain anything you don't totally understand. Okay, so, well, that antitrust is an area that there is an antitrust subcommittee on judiciary. And talked to Amy Klobuchar about some of the other platforms as well. You see anything there? Is there any there?
Again, I share your, I think your skepticism that anything will necessarily emerge through Congress. But what the Biden administration has done is that they've appointed three pretty terrific individuals to their highest antitrust positions. So the head of the Federal Trade Commission right now is a woman named Lina Khan, who's actually very young, who wrote the most widely read article in the history of the Yale Law Review, and has she
redefined antitrust in a way, because it had always been like, if you can get things cheaper, if the customer gets things cheaper, then it's not antitrust.
That's right. And so I think all the three people I'm about to describe would self-identify as disciples of Louis Brandeis, who was the Supreme Court justice appointed by Woodrow Wilson, who was on the court through the Franklin Roosevelt presidency, who was kind of the godfather of antitrust, who argued that bigness in corporations was a curse, and that rather than focusing on what companies did to consumers, which is kind of what antitrust has been obsessed with since the 1960s, he worried more about what monopolies did to the democracy, what they did to people who make things, what they did to workers, what they did to
producers. Like monopsony. He looked at monopsony, Amazon, which is sort of the only purchaser of anything that people produce.
When it comes to something like Facebook, the democratic problem that Facebook poses for him would be a monopoly problem. It would be an antitrust problem, that its power and its destructiveness are kind of one and the same. And so that's the thing that we should be focusing on, I think he would have argued. And so there's Lina Khan at the Federal Trade Commission. There's a Columbia law professor named Tim Wu, who's over in the White House, who wrote the executive order that Biden did on antitrust back in July. And then there's a guy up nominated to be the head of the antitrust division of the Justice Department called Jonathan Cantor. And kind of it's a real trifecta that we haven't seen in a long time, maybe ever, where you've had people in the three highest antitrust positions in the government who are all singing from the same hymn book.
So you're saying not Congress, but the FTC, the administration.
And Justice Department, yeah.
And Justice Department, and that they can do this through the courts.
Yeah. Well, and interestingly, Frances Haugen sent her papers to the Facebook papers to the SEC, to the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Right.
And so she was essentially accusing them of having committed white collar crime. And so, you know, we could sit around waiting for Congress to pass new laws all day long, and or all year long, or all decade long, or all century long, and it might not ever happen. But there are laws on the books that would allow us to, that just need to be enforced. And that if you have active cops on the beat, a company like Facebook is in trouble.
So that provides some hope. And you see those actors appointed by President Biden as the right people to do that.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, that's good. Oh, let's keep following them, shall we?
Right. Well, it's, you know, one of the things that happens is that you have big pieces of legislation that are trucking through the House and Senate, And that's exciting, and those have transformational possibilities, but they're only part of the story. And we live in, you know, for the last couple decades, we've had congresses that don't actually do that much legislating. And so you have an executive branch that has grown ever more powerful. But one of the places it hasn't, its power hasn't really fully been realized, or we've forgotten about its power, is that there are these agencies that can enforce laws that are on the book. And if you have activists there who are pressing hard and enforcing the law with passion, they can do a lot of good.
Well, listen, Frank, thank you so much.
See you in the metaverse, Al.
Yes, can't wait.
I mean, I can only imagine how much more delightful the virtual you is.
It's very similar to the real me.
Right.
I don't know. Okay. Thanks, man.
Okay. Thanks, Al.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.